and around the circle everyone says, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. 3, says Gretch, who had written the task in the first place, and Sandy, a small microgram of paranoia, creeps back in like a mite. The pranksters now realize that Sandy was in a bad way. Kesey had a saying, feed the hungry bee. So the pranksters set about showering attention on Sandy to try to give him a feeling of being at the cool center of the whole thing. But he kept misinterpreting their gestures. Why are they staring? His insomnia became more and more severe. One night he walked down the road to the housing development, Redwood Terrace, to try to borrow some Somanex. He was just going to walk up to a door in the middle of the night and knock and ask for some Somanex. Somehow he had the old New York apartment house idea that you walk down the hall and borrow a cup of sugar, even if you don't know the people. So he starts knocking on doors and asking for Somanex. Of course, they all either panic and shut the door or tell him to fuck off. The people of Redwood Terrace were a little paranoid themselves by this time about the crazies down the road at Kesey's. By day it was no better. As his insomnia got worse, he started having more fragmented vision, and finally, he looks at the wild painted bus, and the lurid chaos of the swirls changes into the tunnel. A tunnel they had gone through, a long tunnel, in which he had been possessed by intense claustrophobia and the paranoid certainty that they would never emerge from the tunnel, and now the tunnel appears on the side of the bus in horrifying detail. He turns away. There is the cool, lime-lit bower, cathedral in the redwoods, serenity. He turns back to the bus, slowly. It is still there. The tunnel. The bus. Now painted as if by a master, a very Titian, an Hieronymus Bosch, a Matthias Grunewald, with the most horrifying scenes of my life. Salvation? Kesey announces they are getting back on the bus, moving again, and going up to Esalen Institute up in Big Sur, 4 hours' drive to the south. Esalen was an experiment in living, as they say, a sort of roughing-it resort perched on a cliff about 1,000 feet above the Pacific. A very dramatic piece of nature in the 19th-century seascape fashion. Waves crashing way down below, and sparkling air way up here, and a view of half the world. Mountains, ocean, sky, the whole show, in a word, for which Big Sur is famous. There was a lodge and a swimming pool and a stretch of greensward out to the edge of the cliff and some hot sulfur springs about 100 yards away, also perched on the side of a cliff, in which one could bathe and gaze out over the eternal ocean. Behind the lodge were rows of tiny cabins and a few trailers. These were for the clientele. The clients... Well, to put it simply, Esalen was a place where educated middle-class adults came in the summer to try to get out of the rut and wiggle their fannies a bit. The main theoretician at Esalen was a Gestalt psychologist named Fritz Perls. Perls was a great goateed man in his 70s who went about in a jumpsuit made of blue terry cloth. He had the air of a very learned, dignified, and authoritative blue bear. Perls was the father of the Now Trip. His theory was that most people live fantasy lives. They live totally in the past, or in terms of what they expect in the future, which amounts to fear, generally. Perls tried to teach his patients, pupils, and the clients at Esalen to live now for a change, in the present, to become aware of their bodies and all the information their senses brought them, to shelve their fears and seize the moment. They went through marathon encounters in which a group stayed together for days and brought everything out front, no longer hiding behind custom, saying what they really felt. Shouts, accusations, embraces, tears. A perfect delight, of course. You want to know what I really think of you? One of the exercises at Esalen was the Now Trip exercise, in which you try to catalog the information your senses are bringing you in the present moment. You make a rapid series of statements beginning with the word, now. Now I feel the wind cooling the perspiration on my forehead. Now I hear a bus coming up the drive in low gear. Now I hear a Beatles record playing over a loudspeaker. A bus? A Beatles record? The pranksters are here now, trippers. Kesey had been invited to Esalen to conduct a seminar entitled A Trip with Ken Kesey. Nobody had quite counted on the entire fully wired and wailing prankster ensemble, however. The clientele at Esalen had come a long way in a few weeks, and many were beginning to peek over the edge of the rut. And what they saw, it could be scary out there in Freedom Land. The pranksters were friendly, but they glowed in the dark. They pranked about like maniacs in the serene hot springs. Precious few signed up for a trip with Ken Kesey, even in seminar form. Sandy, meanwhile, was swinging wildly from feelings of paranoia to feelings of godly power. And the trip was always the bus. One moment it was covered with the Hieronymus Bosch scenes of his most private hell. The next, he controls the bus. One night he discovers he can unpaint the bus just by staring at it. He has psychokinetic powers. His stare bears the power of life or death. The waves crash below the Esalen cliff, and he stares at the bus and unpaints it. He strips one whole side down to its original sunny school bus yellow. The whole prankster overlay is gone. A trick of the mind? He looks away out over the Pacific and at the stars, then swings back suddenly toward the bus. It is still unpainted, still virgin school bus yellow. He has the power, but can it ward off the monstrous prank? The pranksters take the bus into Monterey to see a movie, The Night of the Iguana. He sits in the back of the bus so he can watch them. If any of them tries anything, with one stare he can... They go into the theater and he lags behind, then sits several rows behind them to keep an eye out. There is a Tom and Jerry cartoon on the screen. The mouse, Jerry, tricks the cat, Tom, and the cat goes off a cliff and hits, flattened in an explosion of eyeballs, thousands of eyeballs. Everyone is laughing, but to Sandy it is sickening, incredibly brutal. He jumps up and runs out of the theater and wanders around Monterey for an hour and a half or so. Then he wanders back to the theater, and Hagen is standing outside. Where the hell have you been? Kesey is looking all over for you. Sandy runs back into the theater. Kesey. He looks up on the screen, and the mouse Jerry tricks the cat Tom, and the cat goes off a cliff and hits, flattened in an explosion of eyeballs, thousands of eyeballs. Sandy flees again. Kesey is now waiting outside. He coaxes Sandy onto the bus, and they head back to Esalen. Back in Esalen, in his cabin, Sandy falls half asleep into dream wars. It is his power versus Kesey's, like Doctor Strange versus Agamemnon, and one of them will kill the other in the dream war. He exerts the utmost psychic energy, opens his eyes, and makes out a machine in the cabin. A heater? It looks like a heater, but it is Kesey's death instrument. And in that moment, the thermostat turns on the machine and a tiny red light comes on. Kesey's ray gun. Kesey has triumphed, killed him, and Sandy falls off the bed, dead, lying on the floor. And he leaves his body in astral projection and sails out over the Pacific, out from the Esalen cliff, out for 40 or 50 miles, soaring. And the wind goes in gusts. And he is the wind, not even a compact spirit flying, but a totally diffused being, dissolved in the upper ethers. And he can see the whole moonlit ocean and Esalen way back there. Then he comes to, and he is on the floor of the cabin, breathing hard. Sandy! 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 Daylight, and they're outside the cabin calling him, the pranksters. What monstrous prank. In fact, Kesey had instructed the pranksters to give Sandy total attention, to try to bring him around, to put him at the center of everything. Sandy comes out, sees them staring, but takes it for glowers and aggression. Nevertheless, onto the bus, and they ride out along Big Sur in the sunlight. Kesey and the pranksters have prepared a long Sandy document, 12 pages of text and drawings, very fanciful, like a psychic brief, bringing all of Sandy's fears out front and dispelling them in camaraderie. And it begins to work. Then, as they roll along the cliff highway, Kesey takes Sandy up on top of the bus for a now trip. They sit up there in the sun with the wind streaming by, and Kesey is grooving off the designs on the hood of the bus. Now I see the green snake form going into the red, and the edge of it melts into... and so forth. And Sandy grooves off Kesey's now trip. Kesey. Total attention. and it is like he is coming around at last. He feels on the bus again. And then he decides to take Kesey on an out-trip, sailing along the cliff highway. "Now," says Sandy, "I see the ocean like a sheet of ice slanting in toward the shore. Now I see three suns." In truth, the vibration of the bus has thrown him into the DMT reaction. He gets a triple image from the vibration and shaking of the bus, but instead of refocusing on one sun, he keeps seeing three. Kesey looks up at the sky and says, "Yeah, yeah," grooving with it, which makes Sandy feel very good. But then, nighttime. "Sandy! Sandy!" They're trying to coax him out of the cabin again. For what? Why, the monstrous prank, naturally, but he has power. Outside, they have candles, the pranksters do, and they're beginning a candlelight march down a path in a ravine that cuts down through the cliff all the way to the water's edge. For what? Why, the monst... But then Kesey's wife, Faye, comes up very silent and smiling and loving, and gives him a candle and lights it. And Faye is like complete honesty and love. So he starts off, following them down the path, holding candles, while the surf booms up the ravine from below. Why do they want him to join this spooky procession? Why, for the most monstrous prank of all, to kill him at the water's edge. But he has the power. The candle dims in the wind, and then comes back up, burning full. But it is not the wind, it is Sandy. He can make it shrink and dim down just by staring at it, psychokinesis, then draw it back up, all with his mind. He can control the flame utterly, and it can control him, for they are one and the same, God. And he trudges down the ravine, becoming more and more powerful. But a girl named Lola has stopped ahead of him. He draws closer, and she has a candle, and is tilting it so that the wax drips on her fingers, and she is grooving over the wax, dripping over her fingers, and grinning. And her hand, in wax, turns white and dead, a skeleton. And her grin, lit from beneath by the candle, turns waxy and zombie. The death starts here, and Sandy bolts, charging back up the ravine, not knowing that the whole procession had been set up as a ceremony of love, a love trip, for him. To bring him around, a candle-lit celebration of Sandy down by the water. But he is long gone, running down the cliff highway now toward Monterey, running until his lungs give out, then walking, then running up to the lights in the houses on the cliffs over the water, Big Sur summer places, and knocking on the door, screaming incoherently about jumping off the cliffs until the police come. Gotcha. Which is a joke, because he can annihilate them any moment he chooses with a psychokinetic ray. They put him in the back seat, streaking down Route 1 toward Monterey, wheeling around the curves faster and faster. "Don't go so fast," Sandy says. "What?" "Don't go so fast." "Listen," the cop says, "I'll slow down if you stop staring at the back of my head." "Ah! Look out the window or something. Look at the scenery. Stop staring at the back of my head." So he takes his eyes out of the back of the cop's skull. Two fever-hole depressions. Another moment. The Monterey police held him in the jail in Monterey until his brother Chris could get there from New York. Chris ran into Kesey at the jail. "We've got to get him out of here," said Kesey. "What do you mean?" "We've got to get him back where he belongs, with the pranksters." Chris took Sandy back to New York for treatment. It was a long time before Chris knew what in the hell Kesey had been talking about. Chapter 11. The Unspoken Thing. How to tell it. The current fantasy. I never heard any of the pranksters use the word religious to describe the mental atmosphere they shared after the bus trip and the strange days in Big Sur. In fact, they avoided putting it into words. And yet, they got on the bus and headed back to La Honda in the old Big Sur summertime, all frozen sunshine up here, and no one had to say it. They were all deep into some weird shit now, as they would just as soon call it, by way of taking the curse off the unspoken thing. Things were getting very psychic. It was like when Sandy drove 191 miles in South Dakota, and then he had looked up at the map on the ceiling of the bus, and precisely those 191 miles were marked in red. Sandy. Back in brain scan country, the white smocks would never in a million years comprehend where he had actually been. which was where they all were now, also known as Edge City. Back in Kesey's log house in La Honda, all sitting around in the evening in the main room, it's getting cool outside, and Paige Browning, I think I'll close the window. And in that very moment, another prankster gets up and closes it for him, and smiles, and says nothing. The unspoken thing. And these things keep happening over and over. They take a trip up into the High Sierras, and Cassidy pulls the bus off the main road and starts driving up a little mountain road. See where she goes. The road is so old and deserted, the pavement is half broken up, and they keep climbing and twisting up into nowhere. But the air is nice, and up at the top of the grade the bus begins bucking and gulping and won't pull any more. It just stops. It turns out they're out of gas, which is a nice situation because it's nightfall and they're stranded totally hell west of nowhere with not a gas station within 30, maybe 50 miles. Nothing to do but stroke themselves out on the bus and go to sleep. Scorpions with boots on. Red TWA Royal Ambassador slumber slippers on his big stinger. Howard Hughes in a sleeping bag on the floor in a marble penthouse in the desert. Dawn. All wake up to a considerable fetching and hauling and grinding up the grade below them, and over the crest comes a Chevron gasoline tanker. A huge monster of a tanker, which just stops like they all met somewhere before and gives them a tank full of gas, and without a word heads on into the Sierras toward absolutely nothing. Babs. Cosmic control, eh, Hassler? And Kesey. Where does it go? I don't think man has ever been there. We're under cosmic control and have been for a long, long time, and each time it builds, it's bigger and it's stronger. And then you find out about Cosmo, and you discover that he's running the show. The unspoken thing. Kesey's role and the whole direction the pranksters were taking. All the pranksters were conscious of it, but none of them put it into words, as I say. They made a point of not putting it into words. That in itself was one of the unspoken rules. If you label it this, then it can't be that. Kesey took great pains not to make his role explicit. He wasn't the authority, somebody else was. Bab says, Paige says. He wasn't the leader, he was the non-navigator. He was also the non-teacher. Do you realize that you're a teacher here, Kesey says? Too much, and walks away. Kesey's explicit teachings were all cryptic, metaphorical, parables, aphorisms. You're either on the bus or off the bus. Feed the hungry bee. Nothing lasts. See with your ears and hear with your eyes. Put your good where it will do the most. What did the mirror say? It's done with people. To that extent, it was like Zen Buddhism, with the inscrutable koans, in which the novice says, "What is the secret of Zen?" And Hui Nung, the master, says, "What did your face look like before your parents begat you?" To put it into so many words, to define it, was to limit it. If it's this, then it can't be that. Yet there it was. Everyone had his own thing he was working out, but it all fit into the group thing, which was the unspoken thing, said Paige Browning, and that was as far as anyone wanted to go with words. For that matter, there was no theology to it, no philosophy, at least not in the sense of an ism. There was no goal of an improved moral order in the world or an improved social order, nothing about salvation and certainly nothing about immortality or the life hereafter. Hereafter, that was a laugh. If there was ever a group devoted totally to the here and now, it was the pranksters. I remember puzzling over this. There was something so religious in the air, in the very atmosphere of the prankster life, and yet one couldn't put one's finger on it. On the face of it, there was just a group of people who had shared an unusual psychological state, the LSD experience. But exactly, the experience, that was the word, and it began to fall into place. In fact, none of the great founded religions, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, Jainism, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, none of them began with a philosophical framework or even a main idea. They all began with an overwhelming new experience, what Joachim Wach called the experience of the holy, and Max Weber, possession of the deity, the sense of being a vessel of the divine, of the all-one. I remember I never truly understood what they were talking about when I first read of such things. I just took their weighty German word for it. Jesus, Mani, Zoroaster, Gautama Buddha. At the very outset, the leader did not offer his circle of followers a better state hereafter, or an improved social order, or any reward other than a certain psychological state in the here and now, as Weber put it. I suppose what I never really comprehended was that he was talking about an actual mental experience they all went through, an ecstasy, in short. In most cases, according to scriptures and legend, it happened in a flash. Muhammad fasting and meditating on a mountainside near Mecca, and flash, ecstasy, vast revelation and the beginning of Islam. Zoroaster hauling Hauma water along the road, and flash, he runs into the flaming form of the archangel Vahumanu, messenger of Ahura Mazda, and the beginning of Zoroastrianism. Saul of Tarsus walking along the road to Damascus, and flash, he hears the voice of the Lord and becomes a Christian. Plus, God knows how many lesser figures in the 2,000 years since then. Christian Rosenkreutz and his God-illuminated Brotherhood of Rosicrucians. Emanuel Swedenborg, whose mind suddenly opened in 1743. Meister Eckhart and his disciples Suso and Tauler. And in the 20th century, Sadhu Sundar Singh with flash, a vision at the age of 16 and many times thereafter. Often when I come out of ecstasy, I think the whole world must be blind not to see what I see. Everything is so near and clear. There is no language which will express the things which I see and hear in the spiritual world. Sounds like an acid head, of course. What they all saw in a flash was the solution to the basic predicament of being human, the personal I, me, trapped, mortal and helpless in a vast, impersonal it, the world around me. Suddenly, all in one, flowing together, I into it and it into me, and in that flow I perceive a power so near and so clear that the whole world is blind to. All the modern religions and the occult mysteries, for that matter, talk about an other world, whether Brahmas or the flying saucers, that the rational workaday world is blind to. The so-called, friends, rational world. If only they, Mom and Dad and Buddy and Sis, dear but square ones, could but know the Kairos, the supreme moment. The historic visions have been explained in many ways, as the result of epilepsy, self-hypnosis, changes in metabolism due to fasting, or actual intervention by gods, or drugs. Zoroastrianism began in a grand bath of Hauma water, which was the same as the Hindu Soma, and was unquestionably a drug. The experience. And following the experience, after I got to know the pranksters, I went back and read Joachim Wach's Paradigm of the Way Religions Are Founded, written in 1944. And it was almost like a piece of occult precognition for me if I'd played it off against what I knew about the pranksters. Following a profound new experience, providing a new illumination of the world, the founder, a highly charismatic person, begins enlisting disciples. These followers become an informally but closely knit association, bound together by the new experience, whose nature the founder has revealed and interpreted. The association might be called a circle, indicating that it is oriented toward a central figure with whom each of the followers is in intimate contact. The followers may be regarded as the founder's companions, bound to him by personal devotion, friendship, and loyalty. A growing sense of solidarity both binds the members together and differentiates them from any other form of social organization. Membership in the circle requires a complete break with the ordinary pursuits of life and a radical change in social relationships. Ties of family and kinship and loyalties of various kinds were at least temporarily relaxed or severed. The hardships, suffering, and persecution that loomed for those who cast their lot with the group were counterbalanced by their high hopes and firm expectations, and so on. And of the founder himself, he has visions, dreams, trances, frequent ecstasies, unusual sensitiveness and an intense emotional life, is ready to interpret manifestations of the divine. There is something elemental about him, an uncompromising attitude and an archaic manner and language. He appears as a renewer of lost contacts with the hidden powers of life. Does not usually come from the aristocracy, the learned, or refined. Frequently, he emerges from simpler folk and remains true to his origin even in a changed environment. Speaks cryptically with words, signs, gestures, many metaphors, symbolic acts of a diverse nature. Illuminates and interprets the past and anticipates the future in terms of the Kairos, the supreme moment. The Kairos, the experience, in one of two ways, according to Max Weber, as an ethical prophet, like Jesus or Moses, who outlines rules of conduct for his followers and describes God as a superperson who passes judgment on how they live up to the rules, or as an exemplary prophet like Buddha. For him, God is impersonal, a force, an energy, a unifying flow, an all-in-one. The exemplary prophet does not present rules of conduct. He presents his own life as an example for his followers. In all these religious circles, the groups become tighter and tighter by developing their own symbols, terminology, lifestyles, and gradually simple cultic practices, rites, often involving music and art, all of which grew out of the new experience and seemed weird or incomprehensible to those who have never had it. At that point, they would also develop a strong urge to extend the message to all people. All people. Within the religious circle, status was always a simple matter. The world was simply and sheerly divided into the aware, those who had had the experience of being vessels of the divine, and a great mass of the unaware, the unmusical, the unattuned. Or, you're either on the bus or off the bus. Consciously, the aware were never snobbish toward the unaware, but in fact most of that great jellyfish blob of straight souls looked like hopeless cases, and the music of your flute from up top the bus just brought them up tighter. But these groups treated anyone who showed possibilities, who was a potential brother, with generous solicitude. The potentially attuned. Beautiful people started showing up at Kesey's in La Honda, and no one was turned away. They could stay there, live there, if they seemed attuned. Mountain Girl was waiting out front of Kesey's house when the bus came around the last bend on Route 84 and into the Redwood Gorge. Mountain Girl was a big brunette with a black motorcycle, wearing a t-shirt and dungarees. She was only 18, but big, about 5'9", and heavy, and loud and sloppy as far as that went. But it was funny. She had beautiful teeth and a smile that lit up one's gizzard. Her name was Carolyn Adams, but she became Mountain Girl right away. As far as I know, nobody ever called her anything else after that until the police got technical about it 9 months later with her and 11 other pranksters. Cassidy had turned Mountain Girl on to Kesey's place. She had been working as a technician in a biological laboratory in Palo Alto. She had a boyfriend who, well, he probably thought of himself as a beatnik in his square hip way. Only he never did anything, this boyfriend of hers. They never went anywhere. They never went out. So she went out by herself. She ended up one night in St. Michael's Alley, one of Palo Alto's little boho rookeries, at a birthday party for Cassidy. Cassidy said, over the mountain and down under the redwoods was where it was at. Mountain Girl was a big hit with the pranksters from the very start. She seemed always completely out front, without the slightest prompting. She was one big, loud charge of vitality. Here comes Mountain Girl. And it was a thing that made you pick up as soon as you saw her mouth broaden into a grin and her big brown eyes open, 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 until they practically exploded like sunspots in front of your eyes, and you knew that wonderful, countrified voice was going to sing out something like, "Hey, guess what we're gonna do? We were just up to Boz, the general store, and we're going to get some seeds and plant some grass in Boz's window box. Can't you see it? The whole town's going to get turned on in 6 months," and so on. But underneath all the gits and gonas, she turned out to be probably the brightest girl around there, with the possible exception of Faye. Faye said very little, so it was a moot point. Mountain Girl turned out to be from a highly respectable upper-middle-class background in Poughkeepsie, New York, a family of Unitarians. In any case, she caught on to everything right away. She was decisive and had all the nerve in the world. Also, she was getting more beautiful every day. All it took was a few weeks of the rice and stew and irregular eating around Kesey's, the old involuntary macrobiotic diet, so to speak, and she started thinning out and getting beautiful. None of this was lost on Kesey. He was the mountain man and she was the mountain girl. She was just right for him. Mountain girl moved into a tent up on a little plateau on the hill behind the house under the redwoods. Paige Browning had a tent up there, too. So did Babs and Gretch. Mike Hagen had his screw shack. The screw shack was a very stellar malfunction Hagen production. None of the boards lay true, and none of the nails ever quite made it all the way in. The boards seemed to be huddled together in a tentative agreement. One day, Kesey took a hammer and hit a single nail on the peak of the shack, and the whole shack fell down. "Nothing lasts, Hagen!" yelled Mountain Girl, and her laugh boomed through the redwoods. And the hermit's cave. One day, Fay looked out the kitchen window, and there was a little creature at the foot of the hill behind the house, peering out from the edge of the woods like a starved animal. He was a small, thin kid, barely 5 feet tall, but he had a huge black beard like some Ozark gnome in Barney Google. He just stood there with these big starveling eyes bugging out of his wild black shag looking at the house. Fay brought him out a plate of tuna fish. He took it without saying anything and ate it. And never left. The Hermit. The Hermit hardly ever said anything, but he turned out to be perfectly literate, and he would talk to people he trusted, like Kesey. He was only 18. He had lived with his mother somewhere around La Honda. He had had a lot of trouble in school. He had had a lot of trouble everywhere. He was the oddball. Finally, he took off for the woods and lived up there barefoot, just wearing a shirt and Levi's, killing animals and spearing fish for food. People caught glimpses of him now and again, and high school kids used to try to hunt him down and demolish his lean-tos and otherwise torment him. His wandering had brought him up to the woods up behind Kesey's house, a wild stretch that had been designated Sam MacDonald Park but never cleared. The hermit built himself a hermit's cave down in a pit in a dark green moldy mossy gully that dropped off the path up into the woods. He filled it with objects that winked and blinked and cooed. He was also keeper of the communal acid stash down there in the cave. And he had other secrets, such as his diaries, the hermit memoirs, in which real life and his hermit fantasy ran together in wriggling rivers of little boys and lost hunters whom only the hermit could rescue. Nobody ever knew his real name at all until a few months later when, as I say, the police would get technical about it. Then Babs discovered Dayglow paint, and started painting it up the very trunks of the redwoods, great zappers of green, orange, yellow. Hell, he even painted the leaves, and Kesey's place began to glow at night, and resound. More and more people were showing up for long or short stays. Cassidy brought in a Scandinavian-style blonde who was always talking about hang-ups. Everybody had hang-ups. She became June the Goon. Then a girl who wore huge floppy red hats and granny glasses, the first anybody had ever seen. She became Marge the Barge. Then a sculptor named Ron Boise, a thin guy from New England with a nasal accent like Titus Moody, only a Titus Moody who spoke the language of hip. Man, like I mean, you know, and so on. Boise brought in a sculpture of a hanged man, so they ran it up a tree limb with a hangman's noose. He also built a great thunderbird, a great Thor and Wotan-beaked monster with an amber dome on its back, and you could get inside of it. Inside were some mighty wire strings, which you could pull, which they did, and the thunderbird twanged out across the gorge like the mightiest vibrating bass beast in the history of the world. Then he brought in a Kama Sutra sculpture, a huge sheet metal man with his face in the sheet metal groin of a big sheet metal babe. She had her left leg sticking up in the air. It was hollow, and Babs ran a hose up it and turned the water on, and it spurted out, so they left it running, eternally spurting. It looked like she was having an eternal orgasm out of her left foot. And, Bradley Hodgman, had been a college tennis star. He was short but very muscular. He turned up, or came on, Bradley was always coming on, acting so weird, people would stand there and look at him even at Kesey's. He talked in clots of words. Fell down by the wino station. Insoluble flying objects, nitrate. Greasy greens by the back porch. Ray Bradbury interlining of the lone chrome nostril, you understand. Sidling through the room with a nonspecific grin on and his hair combed down over his face like a surfer, his back hunched over, and then going into a stopped-up laugh, until somebody would try to break up his sequence by asking him how was the tennis playing going these days, and he would widen his grin and open his eyes to a horizon of vast significance and say, "One day I hit the ball up in the air, and it never came down." Actually, there were a lot of kids in the early 1960s who were, yes, attuned. I used to think of them as the beautiful people because of the beautiful people letters they used to write their parents. They were chiefly in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York City, these kids. They had a regular circuit they were on, and there was a lot of traffic from city to city. Most of them were from middle-class backgrounds, but not upper bourgeois, more petty bourgeois. If that old garbanzo can stand being written down again, homes with culture but no money, or money but no culture. At least that was the way it struck me, judging by the beautiful people I knew. Culture, truth, and beauty were important to them. Art is a creed, not a craft, as somebody said. Young, immune. Christ, somehow there was enough money floating around in the air so that one could do this thing, live together with other kids, our own thing. Form our own status sphere without having to work at a job and live on our own terms, us and people our age. It was beautiful. It was a whole feeling, and the straight world never understood it, this thing of one's status sphere and how one was only 19, 20, 21, 22 or so, and not starting out helpless at the bottom of the ladder at all, because the hell with the ladder itself. One was already up on a level that the straight world was freaking baffled by. Straight people were always trying to figure out what is wrong here, never having had this feeling themselves. Straight people called them beatniks. I suppose the beautiful people identified with the beat generation excitement of the late 1950s, but in fact there was a whole new motif in their particular bohemian statosphere, namely psychedelic drugs. LSD. Secretly. Timothy Leary, Alpert, and a few chemists like Al Hubbard and the incognito Dr. Spaulding had been pumping LSD out into the hip circuit with a truly messianic conviction. LSD, peyote, mescaline, morning glory seeds were becoming the secret new thing in the hip life. A lot of kids who were into it were already piled into amputated apartments, as I called them. The seats, the tables, the beds, none of them ever had legs. Communal living on the floor, you might say, although nobody used terms like communal living or tribes or any of that. They had no particular philosophy, just a little leftover Buddhism and Hinduism from the beat period, plus Huxley's theory of opening doors in the mind, no distinct lifestyle except for the legless look. They were, well, beautiful people, not students, clerks, salesgirls, executive trainees. Christ, don't give me your occupation game labels. We are beautiful people. Ascendant from your robot junkyard. And at this point, they used to sit down and write home the beautiful people letter. Usually the girls wrote these letters to their mothers. Mothers all over California, all over America, I guess, got to know the beautiful people letter by heart. It went, "Dear Mother, I meant to write you before this, and I hope you haven't been worried. I am in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Arizona, a Hopi Indian reservation, Ajijic, San Miguel de Allende, Mazatlan, Mexico. And it is really beautiful here. It is a beautiful scene. We've been here a week. I won't bore you with the whole thing, how it happened, but I really tried because I knew you wanted me to, but it just didn't work out with school, college, my job, me and Danny. And so I have come here, and it is a really beautiful scene. I don't want you to worry about me. I have met some beautiful people, and in the heart of even the most unhip mama in all the U.S. of A. instinctively goes up the adrenal shriek, beatniks, bums, spades, dope. At Kesey's, the days began when? There were no clocks around, and nobody had a watch. The limelight would be sparkling down through the redwoods when you woke up. The first sounds, usually, would be Faye calling the children. Jed! Shannon. Or a cabinet door slamming in the kitchen, or a pen being put down on the drain board. Fay, the Eternal. Then maybe a car coming over the wooden bridge and parking in the dirt area out front of the house. Sometimes it would be one of the regulars, like Hagen, coming back. He was always going off somewhere. Sometimes it would be the everlasting visitors from God knows where, friends of friends of friends, curiosity seekers, some of them, dope seekers, some of them, kids from Berkeley, you could never tell. People around the house would just start to be getting up. Kesey emerges in his undershorts, walks out front of the creek, and dives in that mothering cold water by way of shocking himself awake. George Walker is sitting on the porch with just a pair of Levi's on, going over his muscles, his arms, shoulders, and torso, and all the muscles, with his hands, looking for flaws, picking off hickeys, sort of like the ministrations of a cat. There would be a great burst of activity in the late afternoon, people working on various projects, the most complicated of which, endless, it seemed like, was the movie. The Pranksters spent much of the fall of 1964, and the winter, and the early spring of 1965, working on the movie. They had about 45 hours of color film from the bus trip, and once they got to going over it, it was a monster. Kesey had high hopes for the film on every level. It was the world's first acid film, taken under conditions of total spontaneity, barreling through the heartlands of America, recording all now in the moment. The current fantasy was a total breakthrough in terms of expression, but also something that would amaze and delight many multitudes, a movie that could be shown commercially as well as in the esoteric world of the heads. But the movie was a monster, as I say. The sheer labor and tedium of editing 45 hours of film was unbelievable. And besides, much of the film was out of focus. Hagen, like everybody else, had been soaring half the time, and the bouncing of the bus hadn't helped especially, but that was the trip. Still, also there were very few establishing shots, shots showing where the bus was when this or that took place. But who needs that old Hollywood thing of long shot, medium shot, close-up, and the careful cuts and wipes and pans and dolly in and dolly out, the old bullshit? Still, plunging in on those miles of bouncing, ricocheting, blazing film with a splicer was like entering a jungle where the greeny vines grew faster than you could chop them down in front of you. The film had already cost a staggering sum, about $70,000, mostly for color processing. Kesey had put everything he had gotten from his two novels, plus the play adaptation of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, into Intrepid Trips Incorporated. His brother Chuck, who had a good creamery business in Springfield, Oregon, invested to some extent. George Walker's father had set up a trust fund for him with strings on it, but he contributed when he could. By the end of 1965, according to Fay's bookkeeping, Intrepid Trips Incorporated had spent $103,000 on the various Prankster enterprises. Living expenses for the whole group ran to about $20,000 for the year, a low figure considering that there were seldom fewer than 10 people around to be taken care of, and usually two or three vehicles. Food and lodging were all taken care of by Kesey. A pot of money at the front door. There was a curious little library building up on the shelves in the living room, books of science fiction and other mysterious things, and you could pick up almost any of these books and find truly strange vibrations. The whole thing here is so much like this book on Kesey's shelf, Robert Heinlein's novel Stranger in a Strange Land. It is bewildering. It is as if Heinlein and the Pranksters were bound together by some inexplicable, acausal connecting bond. This is a novel about a Martian who comes to Earth, a true superhero, in fact, born of an Earth mother and father after a space flight from Earth to Mars, but raised by infinitely superior beings, the Martians. Beings on other planets are always infinitely superior in science fiction novels. Anyway, around him gathers a mystic brotherhood, based on a mysterious ceremony known as water sharing. They live in La Honda, at Kesey's. Their place is called The Nest. Their life transcends all the usual earthly games of status, sex, and money. No one who once shares water and partakes of life in The Nest ever cares about such banal competitions again. There is a pot of money inside the front door provided by the superhero. Everything is totally out front in the nest. No secrets, no guilt, no jealousies, no putting anyone down for anything. A plural marriage, a group theogamy. Therefore, whatever took place or was about to take place was not public but private. Ain't nobody here but us gods. So how could anyone be offended? Bacchanalia, unashamed swapping, communal living, everything. Kesey by now had not only the bus but the very woods wired for sound. There were wires running up the hillside into the redwoods and microphones up there that could pick up random sounds. Up in the redwoods atop the cliff on the other side of the highway from the house were huge speakers, theater horns, that could flood the entire gorge with sound. Roland Kirk and his half a dozen horns funking away in the old sphenoid saxophone sinus cavities of the redwoods.